The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
You're watching CSI Madrid. In this episode, horrific coordinated train explosions have killed nearly 200 people. Spanish police locate a bag of detonation devices and pull fingerprints, which they share with the FBI. The FBI runs them through a computer and finds a match. The suspect is a radical Islamist terrorist, and justice is served. Now let's flip the channel to what I will call realistic CSI. The fingerprint is a match to 20 suspects in the FBI's database. And as is typical, the analysts look by hand to decide which of those 20 is the best fit. When they do that, they also consider supplemental information. This is also typical. Specifically, the FBI targets one of the 20 because he is a Muslim, and because, as a lawyer in Portland, he represented another Muslim target of an FBI investigation. The FBI tells the Spanish police that the match is 100% verified, and proceeds to spy on the lawyer and his family, breaking into his home and office, lying to judges when they need to, following him everywhere, and ultimately imprisoning him. When problems emerge in their story, like that his passport had expired so he couldn't possibly have been in Spain, they find clever solutions involving terrorist cells and false IDs. It turns out, though, that according to the FBI's own standards, his print was never a match at all, and he had nothing whatsoever to do with the bombing. A later report from the Department of Justice notes, "One of the examiners candidly admitted that if the person identified had been someone without these characteristics, like his religion, if he'd been someone without these characteristics, like the Maytag repairman, the laboratory might have revisited the identification with more skepticism and caught the error." This is a true story. The innocent lawyer is named Brandon Mayfield. This talk is about realistic CSI. For most of human history, nobody needed any special way to identify any other person because everyone was known to everyone through their shared networks and communities. The rise of urban anonymity changed everything. New social and sexual identities, new diseases, and new fear of crime. So all at once grew up all these things that are very familiar to us today. The criminalization of mobility from one place to another. The new function of governments to collect and store information on individual subjects. And a new identity of criminals as a focus of that new state bureaucracy. Governments needed a way to identify criminals. There were many ideas about how to do that, so handwriting analysis had a long run. But one eventually surpassed them all. Fingerprinting would remain the gold standard in criminal identification until the rise of DNA. Today, the FBI fingerprint database has over 100 million sets of prints. So I'm going to spend most of this talk on DNA, but I actually want to start before it with fingerprinting because a lot of these central issues are not new to DNA. They're just appearing in new form, issues that have arisen with every form of forensics that came first. So the idea underlying fingerprinting is a very familiar one that we've probably all heard a million times. What is it? Every fingerprint is unique. No one knows for sure whether this is true, right? How would we possibly know that? But, you know, I think it's probably true, or, you know, close enough, right? It feels right, yeah. But that doesn't actually answer the question, right? So the question is, when we lift a fingerprint off a crime scene, which is called a latent print, right, taken from an object rather than directly off a finger, that's a latent print, and that print is not perfect because latent prints rarely are, what's the chance that an innocent suspect's fingerprint is close enough that they would be falsely identified? And for that matter, how are you even supposed to decide if fingerprints are close enough? In the long history of fingerprinting, there's basically two schools of thought about that. Everywhere except the United States, divides fingerprints into specific points, so these very specific locations, and then gives some minimum number of points that need to look the same in order for it to be a match. Like, fingerprints need to match at 13 points is the British standard, and that number is different in every country. There's no particular scientific basis for this, and one criticism of it is that looking at specific points is actually throwing out a lot of information about the fingerprint around the points. But that's how most of the world does it. The US went a very different way. We're a country with a very decentralized and very complex legal and enforcement apparatus, which meant that historically we developed all of these different fingerprint experts who all did things their own way. And in the post-war period, after World War II, when fingerprinting was really consolidating itself as a professional expertise, these experts consolidated their authority and social power not by saying, well, some of us have been doing this right and others of us have been doing it wrong, but instead by saying, well, what makes a match is the judgment of the experienced fingerprint expert. And of course, the implication of this is that nobody can really question the judgment of the experienced fingerprint expert except another expert. So their judgment is never open to scrutiny, certainly not by defense lawyers, for example. Now, in practice, even in the United States, fingerprint experts usually explain their reasoning to judges and juries using points. But again, there's no standard about how many points need to match. So the historian Simon Cole, from whom I took a lot of the fingerprint history, quotes this amazing exchange between a fingerprint expert and a judge who, this kind of perceptive judge, had noticed that in several different trials with fingerprint testimony, the minimum number of points needed to find a match always seemed to be a different number, but it always seemed to be less than whatever they had actually found to match. And so the judge eventually says, there must be some studies. There have to be. If there aren't, then this is not a science, and there are no experts in it. So far as I can tell, department policy is to be comfortable with whatever you have. And that exasperated judge was basically begging the expert to tell him that that's not how it works. But actually, that basically is how it works. So this is the first constellation of problems with forensics. A lot of forensic practice is based on mythology rather than science, practiced by experts whose reasoning is protected from scrutiny because it's based in standards that they choose themselves and who work closely with and are often overseen by the police. So enter confirmation bias, like the FBI deciding in advance that the Muslim, Brandon Mayfield, had to be guilty. Because confirmation bias is also racial bias, it's also class bias, it's misogyny and bigotry against queer people, it's not knowing what trauma looks like. All of these things help to make some people suspect from the get-go. One study sent fingerprint experts matches that they had made in their own past work, but told them that they were from the Madrid bombing, where it was famous that there had been a mistaken identification somewhere along the way. And with that frame in mind, 4/5 of the examiners changed their mind about their own past matches and said, this is not a match. That's confirmation bias. So, do you guys think it's a big problem if forensics are often only confirming the guilt of people that the police already decided are guilty rather than adding new information?
Yes.
Well, that's decent evidence that none of you are on the US federal courts. The case US v. Bentley concerned a drug-sniffing dog named Lex, who over 9 times out of 10 would alert for the presence of drugs, which then justified more invasive searches, which otherwise would have been illegal. It turned out that his police handler was giving him a treat every time he alerted, which might be why his accuracy was barely better than a coin flip. As the civil libertarian Radley Balko put it, Lex is a probable cause generator. The US Federal Court of Appeals found that that's no problem. And to do that, they drew on a 2013 Supreme Court case that said that a lower court, the Florida Supreme Court, was wrong to insist that dogs had to be reliable in order to generate probable cause. That Supreme Court decision was unanimous. Unlike the Supreme Court, I think confirmation bias is a big problem in forensics. But there are others. Another constellation of problems is incompetence and fraud. Even for those of us who are cynical about the criminal justice system, the scale of fraud in forensics is shocking. There are over 400 criminal forensics labs in the United States. Most of them have had a scandal. To the extent that anybody trains and oversees them all, it's the FBI, which has had scandal after scandal after scandal. Let me quote the Washington Post in 2015. The Justice Department and FBI have formally acknowledged that nearly every examiner in an elite FBI forensic unit gave flawed testimony in almost all trials in which they offered evidence against criminal defendants over more than a two-decade period before 2000. Of 28 examiners with the FBI laboratory's microscopic hair comparison unit, 26 overstated forensic matches in ways that favored prosecutors in more than 95% of the 268 trials reviewed so far. By the way, that unit also were the ones who trained the state and local experts in hair analysis. The cases include 32 defendants sentenced to death. Of these defendants, 14 have already been executed or died in prison. Sante Tribble served 28 years for a murder based on FBI testimony about one single strand of hair. He was exonerated in 2012. It turned out that one of the hairs presented at trial came from a dog. Can I ask how many of you had heard that before? So about five or six people in the room. Isn't it amazing that an FBI unit could admit, that the FBI could admit that an entire unit essentially made up all of its results, which were used to send people to prison and death row for decades, and this is not the front page of the New York Times for a month or a year? There was reporting on it, for sure. The Washington Post did very good reporting. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick had a good series. But, you know, compare this to Carter Page's dealings with Russia, which I know every in and out of as a news consumer. But we don't know the names of the FBI hair unit's victims. If you or I lied the way that the FBI has been shown again and again and again to have lied, nobody would ever trust us again. But we don't treat the FBI that way because we can't. Because if we did, we would have to admit that the whole edifice of criminal justice as science, as fairness, crumbles everywhere you touch it. So let's talk about DNA. Talk. We share almost all of our DNA in common, but DNA matching is based on a part of the genome that varies between people. It's sometimes called junk DNA, not because it doesn't actually serve any purpose, but because we don't really know what it does. But it's not the genes that are coding traits in any simple way that we understand. Since 2017, to count as a good sample in the federal system, we need to be able to measure the genes at 20 different sites in this part of the genome. Used to be 13, matches in the past were based on as few as 9 or even 6 sites, but now it's 20. You get genes from each parent, so 20 sites means 40 genes. And at each site, you can have somewhere between 8 and 27 possible genes depending on the site. So if you happen to be good at, you know, combinatorics in your head, you know, don't worry about the specific numbers, but the point is, this gives a staggering variety to work with. The total theoretically possible combinations of these genes is more than the number of humans that have ever lived. And that's what makes DNA so identifying. That said, some combinations are a lot more common than others, just like brown hair and brown eyes is a more common combination than black hair and blue eyes. Humans don't mate randomly. We create segregated cultures. And so genes that have no intrinsic relationship to each other sometimes end up having, you know, varying together anyway. And that creates some issues in calculating DNA probabilities that have actually been very important in the development of this field, but that we are going to totally gloss over, except to say that junk DNA genes are more independent of each other than a lot of other kinds of genes, and that's one reason why they're used for identifying people. This kind of DNA matching is used in four kinds of ways, and some are a lot easier than others. The easiest is a straightforward medical context, like a paternity test where both people are still alive. So you measure both people's DNA, and if something goes wrong, like the blood draw gets contaminated or something's wrong in the lab, you just take another draw, right? That's easy. Contexts involving crime scenes are different from this because the evidence at the scene is most often incomplete, and of course you can't go back and fix it. So what we're trying to match is an imperfect picture. So think of it like a getaway car was speeding away, someone snapped a picture, and you have this blurry picture of the license plate. You can see it starts A2, and then the next digit is either a B or an 8, and then after that you don't know. I stole this analogy from the law professor, Aaron Murphy, whose wonderful book, Inside the Cell, a lot of information in this talk comes from. So the second kind of DNA match after the clinical context is using DNA to exonerate someone from a crime. And this is an easy forensic task. If my license plate starts F5, that was definitely not my car in the picture. But if my license plate does start A28, that doesn't mean it's me. It just means I'm still in the running. So it's fundamentally easier to prove that a DNA sample is not somebody than to prove that it is somebody. And this is one reason that DNA has been so important in exonerating falsely convicted prisoners, particularly through the absolutely heroic work of the Innocence Project. And yet, even though exoneration is the easiest technical use of forensic DNA, it is often the hardest use inside our criminal justice system. First, because defendants can't always win the right to test the evidence at all. So many of us in this room have fought and are fighting for Rodney Reed, a black man who is on death row in Texas for a murder that, in my assessment of the evidence, was likely committed by a white police officer. Rodney has fought to have the crime scene evidence DNA tested, and just 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court turned him down. Police get to test DNA when they want to. Rodney Reed does not, even when his life is on the line. And by the way, the state's argument against DNA testing in Rodney's case is that you can't learn anything from that evidence now because they've handled the evidence so much over the years that it's probably contaminated anyway. In other words, please reward us for handling the evidence wrong by hiding the fact that we probably framed somebody for murder. Along these lines, some crime labs, as policy, routinely destroy evidence right after somebody's convicted, even if the defendant is still appealing their conviction, so that if the lab did do something wrong, there's no way to go back and prove it. Our appeals system is not designed to let people show that they were actually innocent, only even in theory, that their trial was carried out wrong. So someone like Troy Davis, whose life many of us in this room fought for, never won the right to have a court consider his claims to innocence, even after 7 out of the 9 witnesses against him recanted their stories. And we lost Troy. Once you're in the appeals system, innocence is not even officially what the system is designed to look for, not even a name. Even when they contest the evidence, defense lawyers usually can't get access to DNA databases to see if another suspect might fit the crime scene better. The FBI has worked very aggressively to keep defense lawyers out. So, for example, it's threatened that any state lab that lets them search for alternative suspects will lose its access to the national database, which basically puts the lab out of business. And this is mostly intended as a threat to keep judges from forcing state labs to do that, because it's not like state labs were really clamoring to give defense lawyers access. But it's really a message to judges, you know, to take this off the table. The third and fourth uses of DNA are both designed to show that somebody did do it. I'll call one confirmatory and one exploratory. Those are just my terms. That's not standard. But it's the difference between we found you near the scene of the crime, you seem to have a motive, your car is the same make and model as the getaway car, so now we're going to test your license plate, and look, it matches those digits in that picture. Versus, we checked every license plate in this state, and out of the 20 that match these digits, you seem the most suspicious. One of these is a lot better evidence than the other. But there's a vicious irony here. DNA evidence is the most convincing when it's confirming other independent evidence, which is also when we need DNA evidence the least. It's least convincing when we would want it the most, which is when we have no other leads to go on. And we will come back to that. With confirmatory evidence, right, we had all these reasons to suspect you already. Now we run the DNA, you're a match. The main thing you need to worry about is that the match was done wrong. Crime labs often report matches to make them seem as damning as possible, even if this twists the truth. So on CSI, you might see, we found this suspect near the crime scene trying to start up his truck. We test a stain in the truck, and it's blood. We've got our guy. But they leave out the part where, but then we tested it a second time and found that actually it's not blood at all. We never tell anyone. He's convicted and spends 17 years in prison. That particular realistic CSI is what they did to a man named Gregory Taylor, and investigations of that same lab found 230 other reports where a first test was positive and a second negative test was buried. Those cases included 7 death row convictions, 3 of whom were executed, and 5 others who died in prison. So that's not a DNA example, right? That's literally, like in his case, it wasn't even blood at all. But the same problems apply. Defense teams often get the lab's final conclusion, but not all the evidence along the way, even when a lot of that evidence points in the exact opposite direction. So those are the kinds of things you need to worry about with confirmatory DNA, along with basic issues about was the evidence contaminated. Victim DNA and suspect DNA should never be processed in the same place, but often they are. I read about one case where a sexual assault victim was mistakenly implicated in other crimes after a crime lab mixed up their DNA with the suspect's. But most errors are a lot more subtle than that. And the same kinds of fraud and incompetence that plague other forensics, of course, happen with DNA as well. I think there are some Boston comrades in the room. So you probably know the case of the lab chemist Annie Dukin, who admitted to falsifying evidence that affected up to 34,000 cases. Her department allowed her to continue testifying in court even after she was suspended from lab work. Most of her victims were black. The reason I chose her case out of all the other frauds, there were so many huge, shocking ones, you know, New York State troopers framing manufacturing fingerprints, Houston crime, go down the list, right? The reason I chose her case is that a Boston Globe investigation of her case found all these actually very interesting emails where other workers in the lab where she worked talked about being overworked and the pressures on them from their superiors to just process cases faster and faster and faster. And none of that fully explains and certainly does not excuse Annie Dukin, who lied about her credentials and seemed more remorseful about inviting scrutiny on her coworkers than about the lives that she actually destroyed. But it is a context for how lab work gets so sloppy. And that really matters because oversight of crime labs is almost exclusively oversight of their on-paper procedures. So that's what gets regulated and examined and accredited, not what they do, but what they say they do. And that partly reflects a very successful effort by the FBI, mostly under Bill Clinton, to screen off labs from more serious scrutiny at a national level, but instead leave it up to individual courts to decide on a case-by-case basis if there are any issues with evidence quality. So let's talk about that last use of DNA, exploratory, the one, you know, that you most often might see probably on a CSI, right? Like DNA to find the suspect. So this is where they have no idea who did it. They search a big database looking for matches. At this point, I think it's helpful to delve a little bit more into what a DNA match means. So that idea is not actually very meaningful without a probability attached. So we don't actually just say this suspect's DNA matches the crime scene, yes or no. We say something like, this suspect's DNA matches the crime scene, and that and the probability of that happening by just by chance is 1 in 10 million. Numbers like that are what make DNA evidence seem so incredibly, overwhelmingly persuasive, right? So what does that probability actually mean, and where does it come from? I want to highlight two issues, which if you like, you can think of as the numerator and the denominator of that probability. One issue is, how do we know that that suspect's DNA is consistent with the crime scene sample? This matching is straightforward for crime samples with a single person's DNA, but it is much more complicated when the crime sample is a mixture. So you can think about it like if we all printed out our social security numbers, and then we had them in this jumble where we have a stack of first digits and a stack of second digits and third digits. And now we have to try to figure out, is your social security number in that sample? Now, some of our printers used more toner than others, so their numbers printed darker. So you have some ways to try to figure out who goes together. But sometimes a dark print is just a couple of different light prints that got stacked on top of each other so they look dark. And you can make some educated guesses about the sequence of numbers here, but it's not very easy. And there's no way to know for sure whether you're right, especially when you're not actually sure exactly how many people were in this mix. All right, so this is obviously just an analogy. I'm completely skipping over the real physical details of how this works, but that's to have an idea in your mind. The more people are in the mix, the more digits you have to play with, and the easier it is to say, if you are really motivated to say this, that someone is a match, and any DNA that doesn't fit them just came from somebody else. The more people are in the mix, the less confident you should be about any conclusion that you might draw. But the other issue is, who else are you imagining could have been a match, and how does that affect the probability? Are we asking what percentage of people in the world have DNA that's consistent with this messy crime scene sample, which, by the way, is a question that we can't possibly answer? Or what percentage of people who are the right age and sex to have committed this crime and live in the general vicinity, or what is it that we're actually asking? And how many people did we search to find this one match that we've zeroed in on before we settled on it as right? And that last question was the central question at a trial in San Francisco where the prosecution said that the chance of a random match, if this wasn't the perpetrator, was 1 in 1.1 million. And the defense said it was 1 in 3. So how is this possible? Well, the prosecution was asking the question, what's the chance that a single randomly selected person of the right gender and the right age range in California, because they're using a state database, would randomly match this crime sample? Answer, 1 in over 1 million. This is called a random match probability. It is far and away the most widely used DNA statistic, although courts are just beginning to increasingly reject it. The defense said, well, that would be the right statistic to use if you were drawing one random person and seeing if they matched. But that's not what you did. You checked every single person in a 400,000 person database. And in that case, you'd expect to find some match one out of every three times you ran that whole search. That's called the database match probability, and it's what some influential institutions are now recommending be used in court. And my own opinion, and this is just my opinion, but I don't think either of those statistics are really right. The question you really want to answer is, how much more likely were you to have gotten a match like this if someone in the database were at the crime scene compared to if no one at the database was? Given the kind of search that you did. That kind of statistic is called a likelihood ratio, but it could be hard to calculate in practice because to answer that question, you have to get really specific about what exactly you're imagining happened if no one in the database was at the crime scene. Whose DNA is this then? How many people? And so on. So the statistically right answer is not actually that easy to figure out how to apply in practice. But complicated statistics aside, there is a larger point here. The more people we search, the more likely we are to find hits of innocent people by random chance alone. And this problem magnifies because more and more and more people are being added to DNA databases. The FBI database now contains more than 13 million offender profiles and more than 3 million profiles of people who were just arrested but not convicted of any crime. Many, many others are collected in so-called rogue databases controlled by states and localities with literally no national oversight. So remember that highly decentralized criminal justice system that made all these separate fingerprint experts even with their own way of doing it? Well, now everybody has their own DNA databases. Sometimes that's people who were arrested at protests, even if all the charges against them were dropped, or who were detained as undocumented immigrants. Sometimes it's even crime victims and their loved ones who give DNA so that suspects' DNA can be distinguished from theirs in a crime sample, but then have their DNA uploaded to a permanent database. We should be fearing and fighting a near future in which stop and frisk becomes stop and spit, and black and brown men are harassed on the street until they voluntarily give up their DNA with no recourse because, of course, they had the right to refuse. Police already have histories of setting up dragnets where they ask all men in an area, and it's never a white area, to voluntarily give their DNA and then treat anyone who refuses as automatically suspicious and suspect and subject to other searches. And this database of disproportionately black, Latino, and Native men also opens up their entire families for scrutiny and false matches. The databases can be searched for near matches to try to identify if anyone in the database might be a family member of an offender. And by the way, the person who changed FBI policy to allow those familial searches in the FBI database is the Liberals' Lord and Savior, Robert Mueller. But we should be especially fearful of this because new technology lets DNA be picked up not just from large collections of bodily fluids like a big blood stain, but what's called touch DNA, like the skin and saliva cells that I have now left all over this podium by standing here and touching it and speaking over it for half an hour. We all leave DNA traces everywhere we go. And with these tiny DNA fragments comes a much greater risk of false matching. So realistic CSI includes the case of Lucas Anderson, who even started to believe in his own guilt after his DNA turned up under the fingernails of a murder victim that he had no memory of meeting. What saved Anderson is that, as it turned out, when the murder occurred, he had been in jail sleeping off a drunken blackout. The paramedic who picked him up off the street was the same paramedic who later responded to the murder call and accidentally transferred Anderson's DNA to the murder victim. That's what testing for touch DNA can do. It's the next frontier in forensic DNA, and we should expect a lot more Lucas Andersons, and not all of them will have an unassailable alibi like that. So what do we do? First, I want to say I think this science opens a certain political dilemma for us. So remember, that these database searches give a particularly grave risk of false identification as we search hundreds of thousands of people for matching imperfect evidence without a prior reason to be suspicious of any one of them. Now think about the movement against sexual assault that many of us in the room, including myself, are part of. What is that broader movement's demand in relation to forensics?
Test the backlog.
Yeah, test the backlog, that's right. Test the rape kits. So the fact that hundreds of thousands of rape kits have never even been tested for DNA is such an insult to sexual assault survivors, and it tells you everything you need to know about how little law enforcement cares about stopping rape. But database searches without prior suspects are exactly the conditions that are most prone to false DNA matches, right? And it's obvious that the primary victims of false matches are the people who become incarcerated for them. But it's also true that for people who are assaulted, then being lied to by the state about what happened to you is also a violation. So the question is, what do we actually advocate? And I welcome debate on this. Actually, I really hope we'll have a debate on this in this session. But I have come to think, I don't think we should demand to test the rape kits without that being very directly linked to demands that try to ensure the actual quality of matches. Ensuring that the testing is regulated, for example, not by the FBI, but independently regulated. I think if we're going to fight for this to happen, there's a lot of momentum behind the fight to test rape kits. A lot of places have already started to process the backlog, right? But I think it doesn't make sense for us to join those demands unless it's part of a broader linkage that we're trying to make between the struggles against sexual assault and against mass incarceration and policing, and to not have one of those be at the expense of the other. When, after all, there's a shared interest in fighting false matches. The entire criminal justice system is structured to make it harder to evaluate forensic quality. The regulation comes from the FBI and from courts that are completely overwhelmed and not really competent to evaluate scientific questions. It does not come from independent quality controls, certainly not from community control. A system in which 90% of defendants plea bargain rather than going to trial because harsh sentencing makes trial too great a risk, even if you know you're innocent, even if you think you'd probably be acquitted, it's too risky. And because overworked defense lawyers often can't stand up to DNA evidence, although having said that, I also want to say that an enormous amount of what I said in this talk is known to us only because of the really heroic work of overworked public defenders who put in enormous amounts of their own time to bring a lot of this stuff to light. But a system that leaves quality control to the courts and then forces most defendants to plea out instead of even fighting in the courts is a system that has no quality control. Proprietary matching software. Public labs often run private for-profit software to do their matches, which means that the scientific details of how matches happen are trade secrets. They're not open to scrutiny. Although, frankly, there is just as much secrecy from government labs as often as there is from the companies, and on and on. And this is coupled with this racist database structure where people who have contact with the criminal justice system or have family members who have contact with the criminal justice system end up with their DNA being tested for matches over and over and over again for the rest of their lives, just waiting for a positive hit. This system is not designed for justice. It's designed to punish as the state sees fit with this democratic and scientific veneer shellacked on top of it. But that veneer also opens up avenues for struggle. The work that we in the ISO have done against the criminal justice system, I have to say, is some of the work that I am personally the proudest of, even though my own contribution to it has actually been very small. Our approach has been that prisoners and their families belong at the center of the struggle, and that you can't defeat the criminal justice system without humanizing its victims and challenging the social category that all of this forensic history began with, the category of criminals. So we have far more radical critiques of the criminal justice system than the ones I've made here, right? The point of this talk is actually very limited, but it's just to show how even on its own terms, even when you narrow the question to, you know, let's go find the guilty, even on those terms, the system does not do what it says it does, but proceeds with total disregard for the lives of people and families caught up in its net. The science at the core of too many convictions is just absolute junk. And that is information that we should bring with us into our struggles against policing and mass incarceration and executions. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.